Hi, thank you for downloading the Mode Knit Yarn podcast. In each episode, Annie Modisette or Kathleen Piscuzzi, or both of us, will chat with some cool person from the knitting world, someone you may have heard of, or perhaps just someone down the street who we think you'd enjoy meeting. Our second podcast features knitter, entrepreneur, and Ravelry guide Kimberly Villarreal. Kimberly started, as many of us do, as a crocheter who switched it up and added knitting to her bag of tricks. She tells us about that journey, about her work for Westminster Fibers, and how someone who loves knitting has carved herself a place creating a small business, assisting designers and yarn companies navigate the sometimes rough seas of promotion and marketing. Additionally, we discuss child rearing, life philosophies, and bunnies, both rescuing them and serving them up for Easter dinner. Enjoy this podcast. We're doing this interview via phone, so it's difficult because we don't have the visual cues you usually have when you're talking with someone, you know, where you can see someone gearing up to say something, so you kind of back off a little. You know, we do a little beautiful dance when we're talking in person. It's hard to do on the phone. But what did you study when you were in college?
really crazy. I was supposed to be in business. I was planning on being in marketing because I liked visual marketing. I wanted to get to kind of displays and all kinds of things, but something happened. Oh, I know, I failed taxes. The taxes chapter in the accounting class, which was required for all business majors. And then I switched to computer science and sociology, and I doubled in both. I was leaning towards human-computer relations and human user interfaces, which was just developing at the time. And when I decided to go in there was I was working in the restaurant business in the summertime, and I noticed the kind of terminals they used, and I was just thinking, what if we could make these friendlier? But then I discovered I really hated programming. It's a different kind of language and a different kind of mindset.
Yes.
I cannot create programs, but I'm really good at debugging them, which is really funny.
No, that's excellent. I cannot tech edit anything to save my life. I like to think I'm good at writing a pattern, but that's just probably personal hubris. But I'm really, really bad at tech editing. That's one thing I know about myself.
And I discovered I cannot write a pattern. Anna gave me some sketches. This was for her books. And I tried working on them. And I'm going through. And I'm trying to write out the patterns. And I give them to her to proofread. And she's like, nope, this is wrong. This is wrong. This is not what I meant. And I said, okay. I had taken for granted that with all the pattern entry and info that I was doing for Westminster Fibers, that I had a good grip on how to write a pattern. But I don't. However, I can read patterns fairly well, fairly quickly, get a picture in my head of what the garment should look like. Oh, and I am going to do the tasseled hood scarf.
Oh, excellent. Oh, it's a really fun pattern.
You're going to love this. This is going to go to my FedEx driver. I knitted her a hat last year for Christmas, and she saw me around Christmas and said, I just want to let you know, I get a lot of compliments on this thing, but I need one, something for work. Could you please knit me a hat and a scarf for work?
You're getting requests from the FedEx driver now.
Oh, she's awesome. No, I knitted hats for all my delivery drivers last year. The UPS guy, my overvice dairy guy, and the FedEx lady, and then my mail carrier.
You are so smart.
Some of them happen to be women, so they were very appreciative.
Oh, you are so smart. I need to do that. That is the smartest thing I've ever heard.
It'll be a good excuse make samples too.
The person who delivers your package holds so much of your business's future in their hands, literally, every day.
That's one of the reasons why I did it. It's like, yeah, we've been here all these years, and this is my way of saying thank you. But the FedEx lady, she's awesome, and she's like, can I please request? And that's when I told her the knitter mantra of, if we like you, it's free. If we don't, you couldn't pay us $1 million.
That's exactly it.
And Kathy, by the way, we love you. So, don't worry about it. I promise myself I will use the good stuff from now on. And I only use acrylic when I really have to.
You know, life is too short not to use the good stuff.
True.
You don't know what's going to happen tomorrow, so you might as well just enjoy your knitting today.
Well, I am going to be working on the cowl this weekend.
Now, you're in Virginia, which usually doesn't get a lot of snow.
What's interesting is it depends on what part of Virginia you're from, and since I am on the East Coast, we rarely get snow because we're so close to the water, where in the southwest side,
right,
the mountains, that's another story.
Well, my family's all from West Virginia, and they, every year, would just get totally inundated.
I'm going to be doing two stickouts. I figured it'd be kind of neat to do a kid size one along with an adult one.
I think that I can't wait to see, because number one, she's the most photogenic child on Earth right now. And number two, I love seeing things that have been scaled down, you know, to smaller sizes. I think it's quite adorable. So that's wonderful to hear. But I want to talk about you a little bit. I want to talk about, you know, like how you got into what you're doing, how you like it, what aspects you love the most, that sort of thing.
Okay. I started when I was a little kid. My mother and grandmother taught me how to crochet. And this was in Virginia Beach. So I grew up in Virginia Beach, Virginia. And I remember my mother sitting me down and teaching me to crochet. And I really liked it. And at some point, I remember getting bored, probably in my teens, and I just stopped. And I remember being 13 and doing a lot of cross stitch. In fact, I still have some of the stuff that I did when I was 13, and I'm amazed. I'm like, wow, I did this? Really awesome. And later on, I didn't get back into actual crocheting until, I think, 2001. By then, I was working in Boston and on a commuter rail. And one of the women I sat next to crocheted, and she would crochet blankets. You know, I would pay her like $35 to $50 to crochet me a small baby blanket when I needed one. And there was a time when she went on vacation, and she wasn't around, and I needed one. And so my then-husband at the time, my now ex, said, why don't you learn to crochet again? I was like, you know, I think I will. Went to a yarn shop, started checking out yarn. That was how I was introduced into the nicer yarn, because I was always crocheting with acrylic.
Yeah.
And then I discovered, you know, cotton, and how cotton really is great for crocheting as blankets for people.
It really is, because it's so firm.
It's firm, and it has that nice weight to it.
Yep.
So I did a lot of those, and then it took me about 3 years to wrap my head around knitting. I'm not sure why, but I had a hard time trying to learn how to knit.
I echo you with that. I learned to crochet as a young child, and when I learned to knit, I mean, I took to it right away, but it's a totally different way that the mind works. I have heard a lot of people say how, you know, crochet is really difficult, and I could see that. I could see where someone, you know, switching back and forth between them, there is a little bit of a learning curve that some people find off-putting. Once you can get past that, they totally balance on each other. But that first initial learning curve, I think, can be rather off-putting.
Exactly. So I ended up learning how to knit. Call me selfish, but I was starting to start buying yarn, and I wanted to utilize my yarn as much as possible. Knowing that you use more yarn when you crochet, I figured I should learn how to knit. During that time, one of the groups that I had started going to, I had a very bad experience there. It was a yarn shop group.
Oh.
So being alone in New England, and not because I didn't have any family up there, my closest relative from where I lived in Rhode Island was in Connecticut, and she was in Stanford. So that's almost a 3-hour drive away.
Yeah.
So I started just seeking out other people and hooked up with a lot of people from Boston in the Boston Guild. Ended up meeting a lot of people in other parts of Massachusetts and other parts of Rhode Island. And I truly believe that, and this is the key part, if I was not in such an unhappy marriage, and I didn't think I was unhappy at the time.
Yeah.
But looking back at it, I was in an unhappy marriage. So I was seeking out a sense of family.
Yeah.
From everyone. And I found it. And it's a beautiful, beautiful group that we are in that, you know, they talk about knitters and crocheters. And yes, you have the crazy apples.
Yeah, you get that with anyone.
But, I mean, all in all, we're all a great group of people. And I am forever grateful that I did do that while I was in New England, and because of it, it's why I now am very particular on who I keep in touch with. Now, how I got in the industry was ironic, because my background is technology, as in IT and in data centers. I actually got to design data centers for our USF federal government for a couple of organizations, I'm very proud to say.
That is very cool.
I got the phone call. It was great, and that was back in 2004. The phone call I had gotten from the head of the guy who does our government contracts told me about a certain group who said, they approved your design, and they actually want to implement it as a prototype. I was like, yes! All you nerds who have 4-year degrees in EE, and I don't even have one. So I was very proud of that.
I would be very proud of that, too. I think that's a very cool thing.
When I left the company, the manager who I was under had suggested, why don't you just try to find a job in the knitting world thing that you're in your hobby? And I felt so insulted at the time. Like, what do you think? I'm just going to sit home and knit? And then I filed a gamble in 2009 and basically put out a call to all my blogs saying, hey, I would love to go to TNA in June. Would someone be able to get me in? I'll be happy to work for you. I will help do whatever it takes. And that's when Angela Place, who was the marketing manager for a packing yarn company, had contacted her boss, Beth, and told her about me and said, look, she's a friend of mine. She's really good. And Beth said, okay. And I came in and set up the booth. And that's when I got started at TNA. And there you go. I ended up working for Benjamin. Here's something kind of interesting. At the time, too, when I was looking for work, I had applied to be the IT manager for web. I am forever grateful they never hired me for that position. You know, I still have my relationship with them. I love Kathy.
Yes.
I think they're so savvy and smart. They have, because they asked me, I said, what do you think of it? I said, I actually equate you to a .com, like an actual business, not just a fiber business. You're on that tier of where I think yarn shops should be.
Well, I mean, they're so smart, they're so savvy, and then they're just like the nicest people ever, too. So it's wonderful. I have taught there a few times, and whenever I'm driving through the area, I just stop by and say hi because they're such wonderful people.
Exactly. And in fact, someone in my guild was saying, yeah, another guild that they're in, they're like, we're talking about a road trip to where Webb is. And I said, let me know, because they can do a tour. They can do a private tour with
you. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
You just have to schedule it. And they're like, really? He's like, yeah, really. and then I said, Kristen Nicholas lives near there.
Oh, exactly.
They can go to her farm.
And, you know, talk about wonderful people. Kristen Nicholas is one of the nicest people I've ever met. She's wonderful.
See, I don't know if you knew this, but she was part of my inspiration with my daughter because she had Julia at... Well, I think she discovered she was pregnant at 39 and had her when she was 40. And so with that in mind and in meeting Julia, Julia has developed into this lovely young lady. And seeing her through the years, I'm just like, my heart just goes, oh!
You know, my mother had me when she was 43.
Really? So how old I was when I had Leon?
That was back in the 60s when nobody had kids. When they were 43 in the 60s. Right. I would be rich if I had a dollar for every time someone asked my mother if she was my grandmother.
Oh, wow.
It was hard. It was very hard for her sometimes. But, I mean, ultimately, I feel like I was given an amazing gift because I had a mother who was so calm. It was really hard to ruffle her. She never got overexcited about anything because she, you know, by the time I was 10, she was in her 50s, and she knew how long and how short life is and that the things we get upset about today really don't mean anything tomorrow. And that was a wonderful kind of mother to have.
That's how I'm trying to be with my daughter.
Yeah.
Because there's sometimes when I'm like, sweetie, I can't hear you. And she's like, we don't want you to hear me. So, she, you know, she's just crying. She
yeah.
She wants me to hold her. I'm like, you know what? I am happy to because this is not going to happen again. You know, 2 years later, she's going to be in preschool and she's going to be not wanting to have anything to do with me.
No, she will always want to have something to do with you. I think the whole thing about kids, you know, when you hear on TV shows and stuff how kids are, you know, embarrassed of their parents and all that might be true sometimes, but and maybe I'm just incredibly lucky, but I have never really experienced with either of my kids that I was embarrassing them, you know, or that they didn't want me to hold their hand in public or something. I think as long as you want to give her a hug and a cuddle, she'll be happy to get it.
And that's what I'm hoping. I mean, all of my experiences, I'm going to be using it to share with her and so she can learn from it. Like, I have a love for Denmark. I have a huge love and respect for Denmark because I was able to go there for my job.
Oh, really?
And it was so amazing, really cool, because we were on the western side, not in Copenhagen, but on the western side. We landed in Billund. Billund is the home of Lego.
Oh, my goodness.
So when you land in that airport, you see all these Lego statues everywhere.
Oh, my goodness.
And my first trip down was Star Wars 1, the one with Anakin. And there was a Darth Vader, a Boba Fett, and a R2-D2. And I have pictures of them, and it's just amazing. I even took a detailed close-up shot of the Boba Fett, and you can see the individual brick. That was the kind of stuff that you would see in the airport. You have to drive by Lego's corporate office. That was kind of neat.
I have noticed this thing, and I'm wondering if you've noticed the same thing, which is I have noticed among knitters, I think there's this gigantic proportion of people who are just crazy about Lego. And I think it has to...
I think
it has to do with people who enjoy making images like Intarsia, you know, or color work or something, using little small stitches, putting them together, making something, and there's Lego. That's what Lego is.
But I agree.
That's really all I want in life.
I never had Legos growing up. I had Lincoln Logs.
Right.
And so I've already told my husband, we're going to remedy that with my daughter.
Is she Lego age yet, or is she still like Duplo?
I think she's Duplo age, because she'll look at them. I'm going to hopefully get a couple of kits. She's definitely mechanically inclined. She'd rather play with tools. She'll play with the house rabbits, which is pretty funny. So sometimes they don't want to play. They look at her like, are you crazy? She wants to play tea with them. Pretend that she's having high tea with them and cooking them up a meal with her little cook stuff. And my husband laughs because he says she's imitating you. It's like, that's fine.
Now, when you say the house rabbits, you actually mean the house rabbits, because you have rabbits. That's one thing that you
do.
Three rabbits. Now, how did you start doing the bunny thing? Because every time I see a rabbit now, I think of you or a bunny.
I had a rabbit as a kid.
Oh, you did?
And I still think of Susan these days, and I go, oh, gosh, some of the things I did as a four-year-old. All these things, the reason why you don't want to adopt a rabbit out to a kid, because the parents are not around to intervene.
Did you dress Susan up?
I did. I remember putting her in clothes. I remember her carrying her like she was a baby. She would often hide behind big, giant stand-up freezer fridge things. And so she would always hide back there to get away from me.
Right.
So I had her when I was like four. Ended up, my sister wanted a rabbit when we were in our mid-20s in our townhouse. And so I found this one farm, bought a gray, half lop-eared rabbit, my sister named Penny Lane, and the rabbit got along with my golden retriever, which was great.
Really?
In fact, it was funny. Well, Natasha, the golden retriever, was very laid back.
Yes.
And so this rabbit would jump on the dog's head and jump on the dog while it's sleeping, going, come on, I want to play.
Oh, my goodness.
Play.
Oh, that sounds so adorable.
And Natasha would be like, oh, thanks. And the dog would be like, oh, sleep. And then would stick her head, I kid you not, on top of the rabbit, and the rabbit would finally give up a fine, and then both of them would nap.
So the dog was essentially pet sitting, like literally pet sitting.
Literally. The rabbit was too smart for its own good. It stayed, since we never used the fireplace in our townhouse. She stayed in the fireplace. We discovered she liked it anyway because it was cold in there.
Right.
Nice and cool, and rabbits like the cold.
Right. Well, they have beautiful fur, as we know, which makes beautiful yarn.
And she was fed in a little glass, what you could call an ice cream dish. So every morning she would toss that ice cream dish. You could hear it from upstairs. And you'd hear this clang, 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 and she would want her food. That's how you knew what time it was.
That's excellent. That's excellent. And you know, in her rabbit mind, it was like, if I don't do this to the dish, they will not put food in it. You know, it's like, well,
exactly.
I love rabbits quite a bit. And I think they're some of the sweetest creatures on earth. But I am so allergic to rabbits. And it makes it makes me so sad because I love them. And like, even if I go to a fiber show and they have Angora bunnies or something and I just pet one, I'll be wheezing for hours, and sometimes I'll have an asthma attack. It makes me so sad because some of the best yarn out there is Angora yarn, and I love it, but I can't use it.
The Angora temperament is amazing. They're bred to be laid back.
Oh, really?
Yes. If you come up with an Angora that's grouchy or bad tempered, if you ever run into Chris, known as Wooly Bun, she has a vicious Angora story that you have to get her to tell you. Basically, she walked from the barn to the house with a rabbit attached to her leg.
Man.
And, yeah. That
wow.
was a very angry rabbit. That was a very belligerent rabbit. And she talked about how, like, she was like, you know, I think she had to put the rabbit down. I couldn't remember.
Well, you know, you get a rabbit like that it could cause some real damage, because some of those rabbits, they got some real sharp, long teeth.
They do, and they hurt, and
yes.
they cut.
Yes, they cut and they hurt.
I've been bitten before. I've been bitten, so yes.
I had an Uncle Harold who raised rabbits when I was a kid, and we would go visit him and his wife, and he wasn't like a blood uncle, but his family, they were good friends of ours, so we called them uncle and aunt. And we would go to their house, and he had, it was so funny, he would raise his rabbits and he would show them, and he had all of these trophies all around his house with like rabbits on top, like instead of bowlers or instead of football trophies, they were rabbit trophies, which as a kid I thought was hysterical. And then it's very cool. Well, his rabbits were gorgeous, and they were beautiful. And they were also, they were not raised for pets. They were raised as meat. And as a kid, I loved Thumper, I loved bunnies and all that, but I had absolutely no problem with the idea that those bunnies outside were going to be dinner. Because every Easter, and this is a very confusing and sad thing, but every Easter, my family would have rabbit for Easter dinner. It was just our tradition. Not even thinking, I think, of the Easter bunny, just that that was a really good time, for whatever reason, to slaughter and have a rabbit. And remember, we're talking a family of hillbillies from West Virginia. So, you know, we're not talking, you know, elegant people. But I love that rabbit. I loved fried rabbits so much, which is horrible. I shouldn't be telling you this. You're probably cringing inside.
No. Oh, no, I'm not cringing. I'm laughing. And I'll tell you what. Number one is that Christopher, my husband, had told me when I met him. He came from the biochemistry world and worked in it for a little bit. And he worked in a lab. And he told me how they did use rabbits in experimentation for, you know, this is for our medication. And rabbits are used, and I have to, rabbits are used for a lot of reasons. One of them is that their taste buds are the same as humans.
Really?
Yes, which is why rabbits love sweets. I had Julius, one of my rabbits. You have corn chips. He went after you. Oh, my gosh. Fritos and Doritos. He will jump all over you to get to them.
That is so funny.
I had one rabbit who loved Chinese food. That also includes one of the rabbits now, Worf. We could tell that, I said you could tell he was owned by a bachelor, probably in the military, because Christopher brought home Chinese one time, and this rabbit had sprinted from the den into the dining room and was at our feet, saying, okay, I'm ready.
That is so funny.
That's one bit that, you know, rabbits are actually, in regards to taste buds and certain, I guess, their biological systems can be akin with how humans are. So that's one of the things that Christopher told me. And another one is that he loved, I can't remember the word, but it's conejo, or whatever the word is for rabbit in dishes. And so he's always like, I have to tell you, I like eating rabbit. And I'm like, no!
I know.
But I laugh now, because I probably could eat rabbit at some point. I know I could, but just not my pets. And it's like, I mean, hello, I can eat. If I'm eating the lamb from Kristen Nicholas's farm,
yeah,
when she serves it to me, it's like one of the times when I was there, she puts dye on the lambs because that's they weigh them.
Right.
And depending on the color, it tells you what week they're going to send them to the butcher. So I was like, oh, I saw the dye. She goes, oh, and I went, so does this let you know, like, which ones are going to go when? She goes, oh, yeah, that's right. You're a vegetarian. Phew. You understand. I was like, yes, I do. Actually, I do. In regards to the, I guess you could say the farmer hat view.
Yeah.
I do understand about eating rabbit, and I will say this. The reason why I was against Whole Foods selling rabbit was because they were using farms that I felt were not, I would say, proper, maybe. So that's why I didn't want them.
But right.
As regards to eating rabbit, I'm like, I go to my international market, and there you go. There's a chest freezer, and it's half full of rabbit in there. So it tells you, and I'm like, you know, that's fine.
We always just got them from Uncle Harold. I would never eat Worf or any of your bunnies.
You know what? Worf would be all fat. This is a rabbit. I mean, he is just like the character from Star Trek.
Really?
I'm so glad we renamed him that. Yes, because he's so uptight. This rabbit needs Prozac so bad. He likes to think he's the alpha male, and no, that's not going to work in our family. There have been times when he's gotten a bath from the spray bottle, because I have a spray bottle.
Right.
And I will squirt them, and they're doing that behavior, and it's
a very smart way to deal with behavioral problems with pets, I think, a squirt bottle. It's worked beautifully. People will come over to my house, and I'll be knitting, and they're like, why do your cats leave your yarn alone? And I'm like, well, first of all, I say no when they come over and start to grab it. I don't, like, play with them and say, oh, isn't this cute? I'm like, no. And they usually tell from my voice, go away. And if they won't, you know, a couple of squirts, and I've really never had a problem with any of my cats wanting to get yarn and hurt it in any way.
And that's awesome. The cats can be very determined.
No, they pretty much stay away from the yarn. They're, you know, we give them a lot of other toys, though. They get a lot of love and a lot of playtime. But yarn, they know that that's off limits.
Oh, good. I mean, in regards to the rabbits, I could go on and on.
Well, I have to ask you something. I know you do. You do rabbit rescue. And I love the photographs when you post them of your charming little girl with a rescue rabbit. And I think it's so good to get her, you know, from a young age, get her used to the idea that it is incumbent on all of us to do some kind of a volunteer or help other less fortunate creatures. It's very important for us to do that. And
thank you.
It's good to teach them when they're young, because then it really helps, I think, sharpen their empathy reflex. And I think if you have empathy, not only can you make more friends and understand about how other people feel, I think it helps you solve a lot of problems. I think a lot of problems could be solved if people were just more empathetic and could see things from someone else's point of view. And
you didn't see the gesture that I just did. It was really up this month of the air. Someone from Tiger Woods going, yes! That's one of the things that I'm working on her in. And my husband helps us, obviously, too. It's true. If you have empathy for another person or another creature, you will be a better person.
Yes, you will. You just will. And we are a civilized enough world that, you know, empathy is a very positive thing. I've actually heard people say, you know, you don't want to make your kids too soft or whatever. And it's, you know what, it's not caveman times. We really do live in a civilized society. And the only thing that hurts our society from being civilized is when people raise their kids to be uncivilized. My grandmother had a lot of great expressions. And one of my favorite expressions of hers was, people may have to be poor, but they don't have to be dirty. So her thing was, no matter how poor you are, you get some soap and water. We were a very, very poor family, and so we were always very tidy. And I like to extrapolate that into, you don't have to have a lot of money to teach your children how to be kind to other people. And often it's the people with the least amount of money who are teaching their kids the best amount of kindness sometimes. You know,
it's strange on how people with money who aren't taught that, and it shows.
Well, you know,
if
you can get away sometimes with a lot of stuff and you don't have to interact personally with someone because you have money to pad your way, I think sometimes you don't learn some of the skills you need to learn. I mean, having said that, I have friends who are very wealthy and are the kindest people I've ever met. And I have friends who have no money and they're not sometimes kind. So there's no, you know, I'm saying there's no correlation at all. What I'm saying is there really is nothing standing in the way of someone teaching their kids, just be kind, for goodness sake.
Exactly.
You know, just be nice.
The classic story is that I'm a middle class kid who grew up in private school, and over 10 of those years was in Catholic school out of all things. But I learned a lot. I mean, I appreciated fashion. And what's strange to be in what you and I are doing now is that I remember being 14 and looking at Vogue and going, you know, it'll be so cool, because I knew how to sew then. That's what I was sewing. To be in the fashion world somehow, working in it, and had never thought that I'd end up doing this. And I look right now and I go, I'm in the fashion world. This is kind of cool. I'm on the inside track of the fashion world, even better.
It's wonderful.
I'm not doing retail.
Yeah.
It's like I'm part of the gears that are actually moving fashion forward.
Well, now, if you were going to describe yourself, you know, what you do, what your vocation is, how would you describe it?
I have been telling people I'm in a editing, marketing side of publishing.
Nice.
In a yarn industry. And they look at me like I'm crazy. but that's the best description I can really put on it.
I think anyone who listens to this podcast would get that.
An easy way to describe my job is I say I'm a Ravelry consultant with Mr. Fivers. So, because I do, you know, a lot of stuff for them
right.
for Ravelry, and I set up the Rowan Yarns pages, the Ravelry stores, things of that nature. And then sometimes I'll answer questions on, I sifted through data one day just to see, you know, which particular patterns seem to be the most
popular.
Created.
Yeah.
Now, and that's something that I don't think the young companies were really thinking about. They think about, oh, we'll just produce a pattern and then the crafter will make it. Whereas if you look statistically, and this is the one thing that I kept in my head, the most popular project for the neck on Ravelry are under 200 yards and using size 8 needles.
Exactly. And that's the kind of stuff that goes viral, because you can be experienced or a total newbie, and you can get a nice result.
Exactly. So, I look at that, and I was like, well, then why are some companies producing patterns that are just so difficult? I have to commend you on the book, by the way, your latest book.
Oh, thank you.
I love the book. I want to get almost everything in there, and I have yarn already set aside to knit with them, so...
I've been really happy with that book, because I feel like there's some stuff in there that's really kind of difficult, you know, and you don't want to tackle it unless you want to put a lot of brain matter into it. But most of the stuff I think is doable in like a couple of weeks or even a weekend if you pick a small project, you know, which it's kind of my goal. So now I love Ravelry. I think imagining modern knitting without Ravelry, it's impossible for me to do, because it has so enhanced so many knitters' lives. And by extension, it's enhanced knitters and then designers and dyers and you know, suppliers, spinners. It's really enhanced all of our lives. But I also sometimes, when I go to Ravelry and I see all the messages that I have, I'm terrified to read them, because every now and then someone will feel that it's really necessary for them to, like, you know, tweak me and send me a link to some conversation going on where people aren't happy with me for whatever reason, you know, so then I blithely go to this conversation and I'm reading it. I'm like, wait a minute, I'm not that bad, am I? And it's hard sometimes, yeah. But have you had any Ravelry experiences like that?
Yes. It's one of those jokes where I go, you know, I created a group called ISO Destashing Yarn, and it's where people can literally buy and sell trade yarn.
Right.
And the kicker is that you cannot be in the business. So I can't, even though I created the group, I can't destash in there.
Right.
It's to be fair, because the group was created before Ravelry did advertisements.
Yep.
And then shortly after advertisements were made, we were still having some dyers, because I did allow it at Plot. And then I said, you know what, just blanket rule.
Yeah.
You have advertising on Ravelry. It's relatively cheap.
Yes, exactly.
Don't use the... So,
that's exactly how I feel.
You can imagine the bashings I've gotten
from
our fellow designers and people in the industry on how I'm being mean.
Well, you know, people...
You know, it's fair.
People can have really honest disagreements about how things should be done. And I have disagreements all the time with people. I think what differentiates us from, you know, other species on the planet, you know, rabbits, whatever, is hopefully when we have these disagreements, if we can explain to each other why we disagree and we can try to see each other's point of view, it doesn't have to end in an argument. I mean, it might not end with people agreeing, but it could just end with us saying, I see your point, and I can't do what you want me to do, but I totally respect what you're saying.
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, I understand completely. And it's why I purposely tell people, I said, I won't even post in my group I'm in. That's a can of worms right there. But to use that group as an example, that group has been the reason why, and I joke, why I may or may not have owned a yarn shop ever. The politics that actually go into that group, I look at that and I go, you know, there's a reason why I have a group of admins and moderators. They have certain jobs and to make my life less of a headache, which is great, because I used to read every single thread.
Oh, my goodness. Because you had a death wish.
I look back now because I think it's around like 17,000 members.
Oh, my goodness.
Tell you right there.
Well, I want to advertise in that group.
You should. You know what?
I should.
One of the things, and here's one of those, something I've noticed, is that how you can always tell if someone's really popular, whether it be good or bad, is how fast their yarn sells.
Uh-huh.
And same with their patterns and books.
Right.
If there's a lot of people scrambling for a certain designer or a certain yarn, that always seems to be an indicator.
Yeah.
It's not like what's popular on the shelf now, it's what's going to be popular when it's not being sought out.
Right.
As, you know, not on the shelf.
So it's, and, you know, a lot of things can be popular just because they're the bright new thing, you know, or it's something everybody's doing or something. But then I totally agree with you. You look 10 years down the road, and I sell a ton of patterns on Ravelry. And my most popular pattern, hands down, is the silk corset, which I designed 15 years ago. And it is still so popular. I get people emailing me at least once a month with a picture of them or their daughter in it, because it's very wearable. You know, it's just basically like a tank top that's slightly more sexy because of the way it's shaped. And it's stuff like that. It's like, well, sometimes it makes me depressed. Like, well, I haven't really designed anything since then that people have loved as much. I've designed stuff that people like, but that just for whatever reason took off and it spoke to a lot of people. So I feel really lucky about that. And I'm so happy you're going to be knitting it up.
And you know what? And when I told you that, oh, I'm already planning on knitting it, and for you to be very kind and generous and offer me to knit it in your new Mode Luxe was like, actually the Mode Luxe DK.
Yeah, the DK.
I'm thrilled beyond.
Well, you know, we don't have a version of that knitted in our yarn. And I was like, this is, you know, just to have it knitted and get a picture of it would be very good for us, you know. And then I can put it on the website at some point and say, here's how it looks in my yarn. Because I generally don't go back and change patterns and change, you know, what yarn it's originally in. Unless I do something, like I did something for Imperial Ranch. They have gorgeous yarn. And I did a poncho for them a few years ago, and it was really fun and great. Well, I re-knit it in our yarn also. So I actually sell both patterns. You can buy the pattern with the Imperial Ranch yarn, you know, in those colors, or you can buy the pattern with our yarn. But generally, I don't go back to a pattern and just insert my yarn into it, unless it's something I've re-knitted and I think works really well with our yarn, you know.
I'm looking forward to it. So I'm using it, and to elaborate for those who might be thinking, I'm going to be knitting it for a group I'm in on Ravelry called the Harry Potter House Cup for my Order of the Phoenix mission. So I have a month and a half to knit the corset. They time you.
Really? Let me know if I can help in any way. If you run into anything, let me know and I'll help you out.
Okay. Oh, well, thank you. I appreciate that.
I get literally between 6 to 12 emails every week for assistance on different patterns, many of them not even mine. Uh-huh. So I'm happy to help whenever anyone contacts me about something.
You know, and that's something that I don't think people realize about designers in the industry, especially if you sell one of your designs to a publisher. You pretty much wash your hands out of doing any kind of customer support. But I think because of how Ravelry has the homegrown designers, who don't really work in the industry. They publish under their own name.
Right.
It's changed. It has really changed the ball game of the yarn manufacturers.
It really has. It really has. And it's such a fluid industry. It's interesting to see. And I, you know, there are some really big players in the yarn industry and they do gorgeous stuff. And I think it's such a big audience. There's a place for pretty much anyone who wants to carve out their place in it. And it's beautiful for me to see how you can have very small companies who just do like a very special Angora based, you know, to sell with a Bohus Kits company, versus a much, much bigger company that fills the need of someone who is making tons of blankets to give away for charity and couldn't afford to make a blanket out of a very expensive yarn. So I love seeing that, all of the different yarn manufacturers and yarn suppliers.
What I found interesting recently was someone had posted on Facebook, someone who is looking for a skein of, and I'll even say it, just Karen Simply Soft,
right,
in a particular color. And the woman says, people are charging $30 a skein. I said, well, and this is my comment, was she's not on Ravelry. I said, and someone's like, what do you mean? I said, I will admit, when I had some yarn that I was trying to get rid of, the Walmart yarn, I forgot what the company's name was, that was their homegrown brand, I had some, and I threw it on eBay. And that's where the woman's finding those skeins at $30 a pop.
Yep.
People are going out on eBay and charging $30 a skein.
For Karen, Simply Soft.
Well, and I said, look, I found three entries that are being destashed on Ravelry. Each one was like $2.
Exactly.
I said, so even though we're in this internet connectivity kind of deal, there's still a number of knitters and crafters who are not on Ravelry. They've never heard of Ravelry.
Doesn't that surprise you?
The yarn shop.
That always shocks me.
No, that doesn't surprise me.
Really?
That does not surprise me. I think it's because when I went to Denmark, this was when Ravelry was only not even a year old, and I actually gave a really cool introduction to Ravelry lecture, like what is Ravelry, to a store. It was like 60 women, and so I created a PowerPoint presentation, and I apologize that it was all in English, but the yarn shop owner gave me feedback. She says, you actually played it down so that it was easy to understand how to use it.
Whenever I teach a class, I ask everyone in the class, what's your Ravelry name? And I'm so surprised when most of the class is not on Ravelry. And by the end of the class, it's not me. All of the other class members have talked to people. Oh, you've got to be on Ravelry. Here's my name. And when you get on, make me your friend. And it's really great. It's wonderful to see.
There was a crazy statistic on how, at the time, I think this is when Ravelry had the 2 million mark, only maybe 10% of online bidders were on Ravelry.
Wow.
So I'm sure it's grown since, you know, substantially since then, but still, there could easily be, you know, that's for people that are online. Think of people who are not online.
Exactly.
Don't have access to computers and maybe don't even go to yarn shops.
Right.
And so I'm actually still not surprised of the reach. I do come across a lot of people who are very, what do you mean people aren't on Ravelry? Ravelry's the best thing ever. I was like, but if you're poor and you don't use the kind of yarns that, you know, there's people that $2 for a skein of yarn is a lot of money.
Yeah, definitely.
So you can't really expect people to be willing to pay $35 for a skein of buff yarn.
Especially Karen Supersoft. You know, everyone has stuff that it's like their passion that they spend money on. And you know, for knitters, it's yarn, I think. You know, a lot of it is.
Mm-hmm.
I love yarn. I like to read books online. I like Kindle books or, you know, other type of books like that. And so I was looking over the past couple of years, and I spend probably an average of $10 to $14 a month on Kindle books. Because I love them, and I usually read books about history and factual books and biographies. I just love them. And I was justifying it to myself by saying, well, you know, $10 a month, that's $120 in a year, blah, 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 blah. I'm like, yeah, but that's so much less than going to a movie. When you think about yarn and how many hours you get of pleasure from a skein of yarn knitting something, it's really, it's very cost effective, you know?
Oh, I agree. The fact that you can wear it or give it as a gift.
That's on top of it.
It is a beautiful, usable, functional item.
Yeah.
And I get a kick out of doing that. And people say, you make magic. You're making magic. I said, yep. So,
you just pulled a rabbit out of your hat.
Exactly. My stash actually makes me feel good. I'm in my room right now. You'll see it on my Facebook business page.
Uh-huh.
And I am staring at my fingering wall, and I'm just like, ah. Because every single skein, I can tell you, 95-98% of my stash, I can tell you where it came from.
Oh, that's beautiful. That's a very nice thing.
It's scary.
Yeah, scary but nice.
Scary.
Well, Kimberly, this has been such a lovely conversation, and I'm so grateful that you, and you can hear my cat here, she is agreeing, it's also a lovely conversation.
Aww.
But thank you so much for chatting, and the whole goal of this podcast is just to sort of make conversations that people can listen to while they're knitting or whatever, just to feel like there's someone else in the room, and you're, you know, listening to a little conversation and maybe nodding your head in agreement sometimes.
Conversation, like we were just chatting together, like we just sat together in a room and we're just having
with a rabbit in your room and a cat in my room. You've been listening to the Mode Knit Yarn podcast, and we hope you enjoyed it. The music in the show is Manchester Mystery by Brett Van Donsel, used with Creative Commons license. Sign up at iTunes to hear all of our podcasts, and you can visit our website at www.modeknityarn.com. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, on Instagram, and on Twitter, all using Mode Knit Yarn. Copyright 2016.